This is Lecture 5 in the series Wealth, Natural Resources, and the Environment, and the Political Concept of Monopoly.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, can I be heard throughout the hall? Okay, well, good morning then. I promised that in my last two lectures I would present a concept of monopoly that is consistent with the objectivist concept of freedom and individual rights. Such a concept of monopoly is in sharpest contrast with the prevailing concept of monopoly. To highlight the nature of the contrast, I will call the concept of monopoly that I will advocate the political concept of monopoly, and the presently prevailing concept, the economic concept of monopoly. So that you will immediately know where I am going, I will say that the political concept of monopoly holds that monopoly is a phenomenon that does not originate in the normal operations of the economic system. Monopoly is absolutely no part of a free market, according to the political concept. Rather, by its very nature, monopoly is politically imposed. It is a product of government intervention into the economic system, and in the nature of the case, is based on the initiation of physical force. The contrasting economic concept of monopoly, on the other hand, which is far better known and which is taken for granted as true by almost everyone, holds that monopoly emerges from the normal operations of the economic system, not in any necessary way on the basis of the initiation of physical force, but on the basis of purely economic circumstances, and that the government must suppress or control it by means of the initiation of physical force. Before I present the political concept of monopoly, I want to describe the prevailing economic concept of monopoly. And after I have done so, it will then be necessary for me to spend a substantial portion of this morning's lecture dealing with the general subject of freedom, which for the most part will constitute a review of what you as objectivists already know from the writings of Ayn Rand, in particular her essays, Man's Rights and the Nature of Government, and from the various lecture series and now book of Dr. Peacock. This review will culminate in the presentation and elaboration of two diametrically opposed concepts of freedom, which I describe as the rational concept of freedom and the anarchic concept of freedom. The discussion and elaboration of these two concepts of freedom will provide the necessary foundation for the presentation and elaboration of the political concept of monopoly in contrast with the prevailing economic concept of monopoly. What I will be out to show is that what I call the political concept of monopoly is a leading application of the rational concept of freedom, and that what I call the economic concept of monopoly is a leading consequence of the anarchic concept of freedom. Let me turn now to an elaboration and short history of the economic concept of monopoly so that you will have a clear idea of where things currently stand in connection with the subject of monopoly. According to the economic concept of monopoly, monopoly exists wherever there is only one supplier of a given good in a given territory. That supplier is said to have a monopoly and to be a monopolist. The economic concept of monopoly considers the oneness of the seller to be the essential fact and makes no distinction between cases in which such a seller has achieved his position by virtue of providing better goods and services at lower prices than anyone else, or has achieved it by means of the initiation of physical force. No matter how he has achieved his position, it is assumed that it is a position which automatically and inherently gives him the power to inflict great evil in the form of charging arbitrarily high prices. Now, the economic concept of monopoly can be construed in such a way that it embraces hardly anything or almost everything, depending on how broadly or narrowly one defines a good. For example, if one considers the good beverage, then all suppliers of water, milk, fruit juice, coffee, tea, cocoa, and soft drinks qualify as competing producers. If one considers the narrower good soft drink, or the still narrower good cola, then the number of suppliers correspondingly diminishes. Finally, if one considers the specific good Pepsi-Cola or Coca-Cola, the case appears as one of monopoly, for there is just one supplier of each of these goods, namely the Pepsi-Cola company and the Coca-Cola company. On a sufficiently narrow definition of the good, almost everything appears as a case of monopoly, that is, according to the economic concept. Although the original meaning of monopoly was an exclusive grant of government privilege, which means along the lines of the political concept of monopoly, an exclusive grant of government privilege, such as was extended by English monarchs in earlier centuries to the British East India Company and to various guilds of producers or merchants, the economic concept of monopoly has been the dominant concept for several generations. Even the classical economists held it insofar as they believed that monopoly arises in the market itself. As the classical economists used the term in the 19th century, monopoly applied to goods whose supply, for any reason, was incapable of further increase. Such goods, for example, wines produced on land of a special quality that exists only to a very limited extent. Wines produced from grapes grown on land of a special quality that exists only to a very limited extent. And paintings and statues by old masters, even though produced or sold by a substantial number of suppliers, were held to represent monopolies. Indeed, all cases in which prices were determined by the competition of buyers for a fixed, limited supply were held to represent monopoly prices. Competitive prices were held to be those established by the competition of the sellers based on the possibility of an increase in supply through additional production. In the later 19th century and the first three decades of the 20th century, the economic concept of monopoly in its present form took hold. But the concept was usually used in such a way as to imply that monopoly was a comparatively rare phenomenon, limited essentially to the cases of public utilities and local public transportation, which were thought to constitute, quote, natural monopolies, in the sense of offering major economic advantages by virtue of being provided by a single supplier. In this category were electric, gas, water, sewage, and telephone service, and subway, bus, and trolley car lines. Cases in which towns or cities happened to be served by only one railroad, and in which villages were too small to have more than a single general store, were also identified as monopolies. Apart from such cases, the rest of the economic system was assumed to be characterized by free competition. In the decades between the end of the Civil War and the start of World War I, growing fears were expressed about the potential spread of monopoly to all branches of industry, coming about through the continued growth of big business, especially as exemplified in the trust movement and the waves of mergers that accompanied it. Despite these fears, monopoly was still thought to be relatively rare in actual practice, for it was unusual for any firm, however large, to have achieved a full 100% of the business of any given industry. Since the 1930s, the economic concept of monopoly has come to be interpreted in ways that make almost the entire economic system fall under the heading of some form of monopoly or other. What has made possible this vast extension of the concept of monopoly has been the introduction of the concepts of, quote, oligopoly and monopolistic competition. Oligopoly is oli, same as oligarch, but opoly instead of gark. Oligopoly is supposedly characterized by the existence of a relatively small number of sellers in a given market. The United States Bureau of the Census uses so-called four-firm and eight-firm concentration ratios, according to which markets are classified as oligopolistic depending on the percentage of domestic sales of an industry made by the four or eight largest domestic firms in the industry. Oligopoly is held to exist in cases in which the four largest firms account for as little as 5 or 10% of the industry's sales. Depending on the circumstances, an oligopolist is held to behave either exactly as a, quote, monopolist on the economic concept would behave in terms of the price he charges and the output he produces, or to occupy some middle ground between a monopolist and a so-called pure competitor. When oligopolists are accused of behaving like monopolists, they are simultaneously held to be guilty of collusion by the mere fact of anticipating one another's responses to changes in prices. For elaboration of this point, see my article, Platonic Competition, which appeared many years ago in The Objectivist and has just been reprinted as a pamphlet by TJS. The concept of monopolistic competition is supposed to describe cases in which there is a large number of sellers of only slightly dissimilar products. This concept clearly implies that an element of monopoly is present to whatever extent one product is different from another. The unique elements of the product constitute its alleged monopolistic aspect. At the same time, such products are in competition with one another, hence the notion monopolistic competition. According to this notion, the Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola companies are indeed monopolists, but at the same time competitors. As I point out in Platonic Competition, the concepts of monopolistic competition and oligopoly are actually indistinguishable, both in theory and in practice. As examples of monopolistic competition, a leading textbook cites the competition between Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola, Newports and Kools, and Hondas and Toyotas, examples which would equally well fit under the heading of oligopoly, given the size of these firms or brands relative to the overall market. Indeed, even small retail establishments, such as restaurants, drugstores, and dry cleaners, more popular examples of monopolistic competition, can also be classified under oligopoly, since there are only a few of any given kind in any given small town or in any given neighborhood. Similarly, cases in which products may be physically identical, such as the cold rolled steel sheet produced by, quote, oligopolistic steel firms, are nonetheless likely to be accompanied by important differences, such as in terms of financing, delivery schedules, degree of customer assistance, and so forth, that is provided by the particular supplier. In any case, these two concepts of oligopoly and monopolistic competition embrace virtually all industries except those that are called pure monopoly. All that is now believed to remain in the realm of free competition, according to contemporary economics, to free competition, or as they now say, pure competition, is little more than wheat farming and the production of other agricultural commodities. These are the cases in which an enormous number of individually insignificant producers turn out perfectly homogeneous products. So we have 10,000 farmers each producing a tiny, tiny fraction of the output of number 10 hard winter wheat. That's supposed to qualify as pure and perfect competition, but only such cases. Of course, when one allows for the existence of government farm subsidy programs and the limitations on agricultural production the government imposes in order to limit the cost of the programs, it turns out that even most of agriculture can no longer properly be classified as falling under the head of any kind of genuine competition, but must be described as government-organized cartels. Thus, there has been a virtual disappearance of full-bodied competition from the intellectual horizon of contemporary economics, at least as it applies to the real world. Almost the whole of production under capitalism has come to be regarded as tainted with at least some element of monopoly. Once I have presented the political concept of monopoly, it will be clear that this disappearance of full-bodied competition from most economists' intellectual horizon is the result strictly of the adoption of a fundamentally flawed concept of monopoly. It is not the result of any fundamental change in the actual nature of the economic system from one of competition to lack of competition, as is frequently taught. It's often taught before the Civil War, well, then we had real competition in the real world, but since then we don't. Before I can get to a discussion of the rational and anarchic concepts of freedom, which sets the stage for discussion of the political concept of monopoly, it is necessary for me to review what freedom is and the relation of freedom to government. I'll try to be as brief as possible. On that foundation, and in order to tie the concept of freedom as closely as possible to the material world with which economics deals, I will then show why freedom is the essential basis of security, both in the sense of personal physical safety and in the sense of economic security, thereby refuting the false alternative that one must choose between freedom and security. I will also refute the false distinction that is so often made between economic and political freedom, showing that the two are aspects of exactly the same thing. After I have done this, I will be in a position to deal with the vital differences between the rational and the anarchic concepts of freedom and their implications for the concept of monopoly. Freedom, of course, means the absence of the initiation of physical force. Physical force means injuring, damaging, or otherwise physically doing something to or with the person or property of another against his will. The initiation of physical force means starting the process, that is, being the first to use it. When one has freedom, what one is free of or free from is the initiation of physical force by other people. An individual is free when, for example, he is free from the threat of being murdered, robbed, assaulted, kidnapped, or defrauded. Fraud represents force because it means taking property against the will of its owner. It is a species of theft. For example, if a bogus repairman takes away a washing machine to sell it while saying that he takes it to repair it, he is guilty of force. In taking it to sell, he takes it against the will of the owner. The owner gives him no more authorization to take it to sell than he gives to a burglar to take it. The existence of freedom requires the existence of government. Government is the social institution whose proper function is to protect the individual from the initiation of force. Properly, it acts as the individual's agent to whom he delegates his right of self-defense. It exists to make possible an organized, effective defense and deterrent against the initiation of force. Also, by placing the use of defensive force under the control of objective laws and rules of procedure, it prevents efforts at self-defense from turning into aggression. If, for example, individuals could decide that their self-defense required that they drive tanks down the street, they would actually be engaged in aggression because they would put everyone else in a state of terror. Control over all use of force, even in self-defense, is necessary for people to be secure against aggression. Please note that an effective government, in minimizing the threat of aggression, establishes the existence of the individual's freedom in relation to all other private individuals. But this is far from sufficient to establish freedom as a general social condition. For one overwhelming threat to freedom remains, namely aggression by the government itself. Everything a government does rests on the use of force. No law actually is a law unless it is backed by the threat of force. So long as what the government makes illegal are merely acts representing the initiation of force, it is the friend and guarantor of freedom. but to whatever extent the government makes illegal acts that do not represent the initiation of force, it is the enemy and violator of freedom. In making such acts illegal, it becomes the initiator of force. Thus, while the existence of freedom requires the existence of government, it requires the existence of a very specific kind of government, namely a strictly limited government, a government limited exclusively to the functions of defense and retaliation against the initiation of force, that is, to the provision of police, courts, and national defense. Only one more page, I think, of repeating what you already know. In a fully capitalist society, government does not go beyond these functions. It does not, for example, dictate prices, wages, or working conditions. It does not prescribe methods of production or the kinds of products that can be produced. It does not engage in any form of economic regulation. It neither builds houses nor provides education, medical care, old age pensions, or any other form of subsidy. All economic needs are met privately, including the need for charitable assistance when it arises. The government's expenditures are accordingly strictly limited. They do not go beyond the payment of the cost of the defense functions. And thus, taxation is strictly limited. It does not go beyond the cost of the defense functions. Of course, in a fully consistent capitalist society, taxation itself would be of a voluntary nature, as Ayn Rand explained in her essay, Government Financing in a Free Society. In short, in its logically consistent form, capitalism is characterized by laissez-faire. The government of such a society is, in effect, merely a night watchman with whom the peaceful, honest citizen has very little contact and from whom he has nothing to fear. The regulations and controls that exist in such a society are not regulations and controls on the activities of the peaceful citizen, but on the activities of common criminals and on the activities of government officials, on the activities of the two classes of men who use physical force. Under capitalism, while the government controls the criminals, it itself is controlled by a constitution, bill of rights, and division of powers, and thus the freedom of the individual is fully secured. Now, given the existence of government and its power to restrain the private use of force, the concept of freedom must be defined in a way that places special stress on the relationship of the citizen to his government. This is because the government's capacity for violating freedom is incomparably greater than that of any private individual or gang whose aggression it fights. One has only to compare the Gestapo or the KGB with the mafia to realize how much greater is the potential danger to freedom that comes from the government than from private individuals. The government operates through open lines of communication and has at its disposal entire armies that in modern times are equipped with artillery, tanks, planes, rockets, and atomic and hydrogen weapons. Private gangs number comparative handfuls of individuals operating clandestinely and equipped at most perhaps with submachine guns. Thus, freedom must be defined not merely as the absence of the initiation of physical force, but in addition, in order to highlight its most crucial aspect, the absence of the initiation of physical force by or with the sanction of the government. It must be defined as the absence of the initiation of physical force, in particular, by or with the sanction of the government. The very existence of government can easily secure the freedom of the individual in relation to other private citizens. The crucial matter is the individual's freedom in relation to the government. It is important to realize that freedom is the foundation both of personal and of economic security. The existence of freedom directly and immediately establishes personal security in the sense of safety from the initiation of physical force. When one is free, one is safe, secure from common crime, because what one is free of or free from is precisely the initiation of physical force. You should immediately observe the absurdity of claims by far-left lawyers that to have a free society, we have to tolerate criminals running wild in the streets. The direct opposite is true. The fact that freedom is the absence of the initiation of physical force also means that peace is a corollary of freedom.
Where there is freedom, there is peace, because there is no use of force. Insofar as force is not initiated, the use of force in defense or retaliation need not take place. Peace, in this sense, is one of the most desirable features of freedom. Nothing could be more valuable or honorable. There is, however, a different sense in which peace of some sort can exist. Here, one group threatens another with the initiation of force, and the other offers no resistance but simply obeys. This is the peace of slaves and cowards. It is the kind of peace corrupt intellectuals long urged on the relatively free people of the Western world in relation to the aggression of the communist world. Freedom is the precondition of economic security along with personal safety, because it is an essential requirement for individuals being able to act on their rational judgment. When they possess freedom, individuals can consider their circumstances and then choose the course of action that they judge to be most conducive to their economic well-being and thus to their economic security. In addition, they can benefit from the like choices of those with whom they deal. Under freedom, everyone can choose to do whatever he judges to be most in his own interest, without fear of being stopped by the physical force of anyone else, so long as he himself does not initiate the use of physical force. This means, for example, that he can take the highest paying job he can find and buy from the most competitive sellers he can find. At the same time, he can keep all the income he earns and save as much of it as he likes, investing his savings in the most profitable ways he can. The only thing he cannot do is use force himself. With the use of force prohibited, the way an individual increases the money he earns is by using his reason to figure out how to offer other people more or better goods and services for the same money, since this is the means of inducing them voluntarily to spend more of their funds in buying from him rather than from competitors. Thus, freedom is the basis of everyone's being as secure as the exercise of his own reason and the reason of his suppliers can make him. The detailed demonstration of the fact that economic freedom is the foundation of economic security is a major theme of my forthcoming book and of the lectures I've delivered over the years here at TJS. For example, in various lectures, I've shown that free competition is actually a leading source of economic security rather than any kind of threat to it, and that such phenomena as inflation, depressions, and mass unemployment, leading causes of economic insecurity, are results of violations of economic freedom by the government, and not at all, as is widely believed, of economic freedom itself. The harmony between freedom and security that I uphold is, of course, in direct opposition to the prevailing view that in order to achieve economic security, one must violate economic freedom and establish a welfare state. The existence of the social security system in the United States and other countries both represents a leading consequence of this mistaken belief and provides essential evidence about what is wrong with it. In the name of economic security, the freedom of individuals to dispose of their own incomes has been violated as they have been forced to contribute to the social security system. A major consequence of this is that an enormous amount of savings has been diverted from private individuals into the hands of the government. Had those savings remained in the hands of the individuals, they would have been invested and would thus have helped to finance the productive activities of the economic system, by such means as providing for the construction of new factories and the purchase of more and better machinery. In the hands of the government, these savings have been dissipated in current consumption. This has resulted from the fact that the government has an overwhelmingly greater interest in its own immediate financial needs than in the future economic security of any private individuals, and thus has spent the funds in financing its current expenditures. This has meant the dissipation of these savings and thus the serious undermining of the productive ability of the entire economic system. These results have proceeded from the essential nature of the case, which is that while private individuals have an interest in their long-run future economic security and will provide for it if they are left free to do so, the government does not have such an interest. The interest of the government officials is to get by in their term of office and leave the problems of the future to their successors. Thus, the violation of freedom, of economic freedom, necessarily results in making individuals less secure. Indeed, having been deprived of the existence of actual savings to provide for their future economic security, individuals are now in a position of having to depend on the largesse of future legislators who will have to turn to future taxpayers for the necessary funds. This arrangement has much more in common with the gross insecurity of living as a beggar than it has with any actual economic security. Naturally, the problem of economic insecurity of prospective Social Security recipients and of everyone else is compounded by the fact that an inevitable accompaniment of the welfare state is fiat money, which makes all contractual obligations stated in fixed sums of money essentially meaningless. In opposition to all such delusions, a leading theme of my work as an economist is to show that to achieve economic security, the essential requirement is precisely economic freedom. Although my emphasis as an economist is necessarily on the importance of economic freedom, this fact should not be taken in any way to mean any lack of concern on my part for political freedom. Economic freedom and political freedom are indivisible. They are, in fact, merely different aspects of the same thing. The alleged dichotomy between economic freedom and political freedom, between property rights and human rights, is groundless. Virtually every human activity employs wealth, property. That fact was well illustrated in my opening lecture. To respect the right and freedom to use property is to respect the right and freedom to carry on the activities in which property is used. To deny the right and freedom to carry on such activities is to deny the right and freedom to use the property involved. For example, the freedom of speech is implied in a farmer's right to use his pasture as he sees fit. The farmer's property rights include his right to invite people onto his land to deliver and hear a speech. Any effort by the government to stop or prevent such a speech is an obvious interference with the farmer's property rights. Property rights also include the right to build meeting halls and radio and television stations and to use them to propound whatever ideas one likes. Freedom of speech is fully contained in the economic freedom of the owners of property of the kind that facilitates speech to use their property as they see fit. By the same token, the freedom of speech of those who do not own such property is implied in their right and freedom to buy the use of such property from those who do own it and are willing to rent it to them. Government interference with any such speech is simultaneously an interference with the property rights of the owners of meeting halls and radio and television stations to use or rent their facilities as they see fit. In exactly the same way, freedom of the press is fully contained in the freedom of an individual to set his type, to form the words he wants to form, and then use his press's paper and ink to reproduce those words, and to sell such services to buyers of his choice. Freedom of travel is contained in the property right to build railroads and highways, automobiles and airplanes, to drive one's automobile where one likes, or buy a bus, train, or plane ticket from any willing seller. It is contained in the freedom to use one's shoes to walk across the frontier. In prohibiting the freedom of speech, press, or travel, one prohibits property owners from using their property as they wish. By the same token, in respecting property rights, one respects these freedoms. On this basis, one should observe the irony of alleged conservative defenders of property rights advocating such things as anti-pornography legislation, a violation of the property rights of press owners, and of alleged liberal defenders of civil liberties repeatedly advocating the violation of property rights. Finally, I come now to the subject of the rational versus the anarchic concept of freedom. The concept of freedom, when employed rationally, presupposes the existence of reality, and with it, the laws of nature, the necessity of choice among alternatives, and the fact that if one resorts to force, one must expect to be met by force. Of particular importance is the fact that it presupposes the necessity of having the voluntary cooperation of everyone who is to aid in an activity, including the owners of any of the property that may be involved. After taking for granted the presence of all this, after taking for granted the presence of this very considerable context, the rational concept of freedom then focuses on the absence of one particular thing, the initiation of physical force, in particular by the government. So we've got a whole enormous context. Reality exists, all the laws of nature, the laws of logic, the necessity of choosing among alternatives, the need to get the voluntary cooperation of everyone involved. All of this is the positive context presupposed by the rational concept of freedom, which then, taking all this for granted, focuses on the absence of this one particular thing, the initiation of physical force, in particular by the government. In sharpest contrast to the rational concept of freedom is the anarchic concept. The anarchic concept of freedom evades and seeks to obliterate the fundamental and radical distinction that exists between two sorts of obstacles to the achievement of a goal or desire. Obstacles, in quotes, constituted by the ordinary facts of reality, including other people's voluntary choices, and obstacles constituted by the government's threat to use physical force. In other words, the anarchic concept of freedom drops the whole context that I've named, which the rational concept presupposes. For example, by the nature of things, it is impossible for me to square circles, walk through walls, or be in two places at the same time. It is also not possible for me, in the actual circumstances of my life, to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry or the Academy Award for Best Actor of the Year, or to enter the automobile or steel business. There are all kinds of things I simply cannot do. And among the things I could do, there are many I choose not to do because I judge the consequences to myself to be highly undesirable. For example, I cannot arbitrarily decide to walk off my job in the middle of winter to take a vacation in the sun, without the very strong likelihood of being fired. I cannot drive down a city street at 90 miles an hour, nor can I strike or kill another without running the risk of paying the penalty for violating the law. And then there are a great many things that are possible for me to do and that I would very much like to do, but that would require the consent of other people, which consent they are unwilling to give. In this category are such things as having my views published in the New York Times, or having my writings assigned in courses at various leading liberal universities. Absolutely none of these facts constitutes a violation of freedom, a denial of rights, or anything of the kind. In order for a violation of freedom to exist, it is not sufficient merely that someone be unable to achieve what he desires. What is necessary is that the specific thing stopping him be the initiation of physical force. In particular, the government's threat to use force against him in response to an action of his that does not represent the use of force. The stock in trade of the anarchic concept of freedom, however, is to construe precisely such facts as a violation of freedom and rights. On the basis of the anarchic concept of freedom, it is claimed that freedom is violated any time there is anything that, for whatever reason, a person cannot do, from flying to the moon to being able to afford a house or a college education that is beyond his means to committing murder. Ironically, the anarchic concept of freedom is implicitly accepted by conservatives and fascists as well as by anarchists and hippies. This is evident in the arguments they advance when they seek to establish the principle that it is necessary and proper to violate freedom. For example, they argue that we do not allow a man the freedom to murder his mother-in-law or to speed through red lights and thereby threaten the lives of others. In propounding such arguments, the conservatives and fascists casually neglect the fact that such acts constitute the initiation of force and are so far from representing freedom that their prohibition is what actually constitutes freedom. The anarchic concept of freedom, of course, is present in the assertions of communists and socialists that their freedom of speech is violated because they are threatened with arrest for attempting to disrupt the speech of an invited speaker by shouting him down or by speaking at the same time. This assertion by the communists and socialists neglects the fact that their action constitutes the use of somebody's property against his will, somebody else's property against his will, namely the use of the meeting room against the will of the owner or lessee who wants the invited speaker to speak, not the disruptors. It is thus the action of the communists and socialists which is a violation of freedom in this instance, a genuine violation of the freedom of speech. Remember, the freedom of speech is violated only if, after having obtained the voluntary cooperation of the owner of the facilities, one is prevented from speaking by the initiation of physical force. The communists and socialist hecklers initiate force in using the owner's property against his will. It follows from this discussion of the erroneous claims of the communists and socialists that a prohibition on arbitrarily shouting fire in a crowded theater should not be construed as any kind of limitation on the freedom of speech. Arbitrarily shouting fire constitutes a violation of the property rights of the theater owner and of the other ticket holders, whom it prevents from using their property as they wish. When one holds the context of the rational concept of freedom, it becomes clear that it is no more a violation of freedom of speech to prohibit such speech, shouting fire in the crowded theater, than it is to prohibit the speech of disruptive hecklers or the speech of an uninvited guest who might choose to deliver a harangue in one's living room in the middle of the night. Violations of freedom of speech occur only when the speaker has the consent of the property owners involved and then is prohibited from speaking by means of the initiation of physical force, in particular by the government or by private individuals acting with the sanction of the government. Because of the confusions that have been introduced into the concept of freedom, it is necessary to set matters right in a number of important concrete instances. Thus, the freedom of speech is violated not when an individual does not receive an invitation to speak somewhere, but when he does receive it and is stopped by the government or by private individuals acting with the sanction of the government from accepting the invitation or exercising it. It is violated precisely by the communist and socialist disruptors whom the police refuse to remove. Ironically, in the case of a live theatrical performance, the freedom of speech is violated precisely when someone arbitrarily shouts fire. He violates the freedom of speech of the actors on stage. The freedom of the press is violated and censorship exists not when a newspaper refuses to publish a story or a column that, for any reason, it regards as unworthy of publication, but when it is prepared to publish a piece and is stopped from doing so by the government. Thus, if I want to print my views in the New York Times, but can neither afford the advertising rates nor persuade the publisher to give me space, my freedom of the press is not violated. I am not a victim of censorship. But suppose I do have the money to pay the advertising rates or could persuade the publisher to print my views and the government disallows it. That would be a violation of the freedom of press. That would be censorship. It is a violation of the freedom of my freedom of the press if the government stops me from mimeographing leaflets, if that is all I can afford to do to spread my ideas, or to write letters to people if I still have even less means. Again, censorship exists not when the sponsor of a television program refuses to pay for the broadcast of ideas he considers false and vicious, but when he does approve of the ideas he is asked to sponsor and yet is stopped from sponsoring them. For example, by an implicit threat of the government not to renew the license of the television station or arbitrarily to deny him some permission he requires in some important aspect of his business. both of which entail the threat of initiating force. In the same way, if I ask a woman to marry me and she says no, my freedom is not violated. It is only violated if she says yes, and the government then stops me from marrying her, say by virtue of a law concerning marriages among people of different races, religions, or blood types. Or finally, if I want to travel to Florida but lack the ability to pay the cost of doing so, my freedom of travel is in no way violated. But suppose I do have the ability to pay the cost and want to pay it, but the government stops me, say with a wall around my city, as existed until recently in East Berlin, or with a passport restriction, or a price control on oil and oil products that creates a shortage of gasoline and aviation fuel, and thus stops me from driving and the airlines from flying. Then my freedom of travel is violated. What is essential in all these cases is not the fact that there is something that I cannot do for one reason or another, but what it is specifically that stops me. Only if what stops me is specifically the initiation of physical force, by the government in particular, only then is my freedom violated. What is essential always to keep in mind is that since freedom is the absence of the initiation of physical force, every attempt to justify any form of restriction or limitation on freedom is actually an attempt, knowingly or unknowingly, to unleash the initiation of physical force. As such, it is an attempt to unleash the destruction of human life and property, and for this reason should be regarded as absolutely evil. What makes the anarchic concept of freedom so destructive is precisely the fact that in divorcing the concept of freedom from the context of reality, it both seeks to establish a freedom to initiate physical force, and then on the basis of the consequences of such a perverted concept of freedom, provides seeming justification for the violation of freedom. Now just think as a concrete, the communists and socialists claim freedom means they can get up and disrupt your talk. Well, they claim that's justified with their concept of freedom. This is obviously utterly ridiculous. And if this is the accepted concept of freedom, the next consequence is we can't have such freedom. We'll be required to abridge freedom. And that is now taking root in the culture. You can find open demands for the violation of freedom for the first time. In just a moment, I'll begin to unmask the influence of the anarchic concept of freedom in the distortions that have taken place in the concepts of freedom of competition and freedom of entry into industry, and then in connection with the concept of monopoly. If there is anything for which capitalism is more strongly denounced than its competition, it is its alleged lack of competition and tendencies toward monopoly. These denunciations stem from a failure properly to understand the meaning of freedom, of competition and of monopoly. The terms freedom of competition and monopoly are usually understood in the light of the anarchic rather than the rational concept of freedom. According to the rational concept of freedom, of course, freedom means the absence of the initiation of physical force. Viewed in a positive light, freedom is the freedom to do whatever one is otherwise capable of doing, unconstrained by the initiation of physical force. Applied to the realm of competition, if a man possesses only a few thousand dollars of capital, or no capital at all, freedom for him does not mean the ability to enter into competition with General Motors. It does mean the ability to do whatever he is capable of doing with the few thousand dollars of capital he has, or with his abilities unaided by any capital, without being stopped by the government. It means, for example, that if he can afford to buy a taxi cab or a liquor store and judges that that is what it is best for him to do, he will not be stopped from doing it by licensing laws. It means that if he is capable of working at a job and can find an employer willing to hire him, he will not be stopped from working by minimum wage laws or by laws giving coercive power to labor unions, in both of which cases, a part of the supply of labor is forced into unemployment by wages being forcibly raised above the market level, and thus prohibiting the competition of the unemployed. And if a man or a company does have the capital required to compete with General Motors and wishes to compete, freedom means for him that he will not be stopped by a tariff or by antitrust laws preventing mergers and the growth of big business. For example, it means that Toyota and Nissan will not be stopped, and that if U.S. Steel, Exxon, Boeing, or IBM want to enter the automobile business, they will not be stopped. These are examples of genuine freedom of competition. Freedom of competition does not mean that one is automatically able to compete, that one automatically has the necessary knowledge, capital, or whatever else may be required to compete. It means merely that insofar as one does have the means of competing, one will not be stopped from exercising those means by the initiation of physical force. The fact that freedom of competition does not guarantee that one will be able to compete, the fact that freedom in general does not guarantee that one will be able to do whatever it is one would like to do, because freedom by itself does not supply the necessary means, does not reduce the concept of freedom to the status of a trivial luxury capable of being enjoyed only by the wealthy, as the Marxists claim. Freedom, including the freedom of competition, is a vital necessity for everyone at all levels of economic means. It means, in essence, the freedom of opportunity, the freedom to exploit the opportunities one already has on whatever level one is, and so later on be capable of enjoying greater opportunities. It means, for example, that an impoverished black youth is able to take a low-paying job if that is the best he can find, and then, with the experience and skill he gains from that job, go on to something better. It means that he is able to keep the income he earns from that job, and if he wishes, save it to buy a taxi cab or any other kind of business he can afford, and so further increase his ability to earn money. Freedom of opportunity, freedom thus understood as the freedom of opportunity, the freedom to do what you can at the level you're at, is vital to everyone. Not only does everyone need freedom for himself, but he also benefits from the freedom of others. Everyone in the world is vastly more prosperous because Thomas Edison and Henry Ford and all the other great inventors and industrialists had the freedom to implement their ideas and bring their products to the market. The general gains from the freedom of lesser men are no less real. For example, there is a gain to everyone who uses such services as those of barbers and tailors that those best able to provide such services be free to provide them. The freedom of all is a condition in which every industry can be carried on by those best suited in the world to conduct it. It is a condition in which each can be supplied by the best choice of suppliers. This is the meaning of freedom of competition, that every industry and occupation should be legally open to everyone who judges that he is equipped to succeed in it and who wishes to try, and that then the buyers should be free to choose among them. In connection with this discussion, it should be realized that the existence of high capital requirements as a condition for being able to compete does not constitute a, quote, barrier to entry in any legitimate sense, despite the frequency of the claim that it does. The fact that in present conditions it may take $1 billion or more to build a competitive-sized automobile factory or steel mill does not represent a violation or limitation of the freedom of entry or competition. On the contrary, it is the result of the fact that in order to be profitable, it is necessary to produce at low costs, thanks precisely to the freedom of competition. The high capital is necessary only in order to produce on a large scale and with the use of capital-intensive methods of production, both of which are means of achieving low costs of production. If the achievement of low costs was not necessary, then neither would be the substantial sums that must be invested to reduce costs. High capital requirements would not exist. What makes it necessary to achieve low costs of production is the fact that others who employ large sums of capital and who thereby achieve low costs of production sell at correspondingly low prices, which make it impossible to succeed in the business while producing at the high costs resulting from lack of sufficient capital. In the simplest possible terms, the high capital of General Motors and the other major automobile companies does indeed stop people with capitals as limited as those of neighborhood grocers from producing automobiles. This is as it should be. In order for people to be able to succeed in the automobile business with such limited capitals, automobiles would have to be produced without the aid of substantial machinery or the use of such things as moving assembly lines, which require a very high volume of output and thus of capital. As a result, they would have to be produced at an extremely high cost, comparable to the cost that existed in the early years of the industry. And thus, they would have to sell at correspondingly high prices. It also follows from this discussion that in order to achieve the competitive advantages of the possession of a large capital, a firm must sell at prices that reflect its low costs of production. If it does not, then it opens the door to firms with smaller capitals and higher costs of production who can then succeed in the business and possibly accumulate the capital necessary themselves to achieve the lower level of costs. Thus, high capital requirements are the result of the freedom of competition, which results in low costs of production and low prices, and which necessitates the possession of substantial capital where that is the means of achieving low costs and low prices. High capital requirements are an illustration of the principle that under the freedom of competition and the freedom of entry, the only way one keeps others out of a field is by producing better and more effectively. Where the freedom of competition and the freedom of entry are violated, on the other hand, it is the better, more economical producers, including those with larger capitals, who are kept out by means of the initiation of physical force. Well, consistent with the rational concept of freedom in general and of freedom of competition in particular, that I have expounded up to now, is what I have called the political concept of monopoly. According to the political concept of monopoly, monopoly is a market or part of a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force by the government. Monopoly is a market or part of a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force by the government. Monopoly exists insofar as the freedom of competition is violated, with the freedom of competition being understood as the absence of the initiation of physical force as the specific preventive of competition. Where there is no initiation of physical force to violate the freedom of competition, there is no monopoly. The freedom of competition is violated only insofar as individuals are excluded from markets or parts of markets by means of the initiation of physical force. Monopoly is thus a market or part of a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force. It is thus, as I have said, something that is imposed upon the market from without, imposed by the government. Private individuals, gangsters, can initiate force to reserve markets only if the government allows it and thereby sanctions it. Thus, as I understand matters, monopoly is not something which emerges from the normal operation of the economic system and which the government must control. That is the economic concept of monopoly, which is the corollary of the anarchic concept of freedom and its implication that private individuals can violate the freedom of speech and press by their mere refusal to provide others with material means for spreading their ideas, and can violate the freedom of competition by virtue of their possession of larger capitals and superior abilities.
Rationally understood, monopoly is external to the normal operation of the economic system and is imposed from without by the government or with the government's sanction. The leading examples of monopoly rationally understood, that is, according to the political concept, are exclusive government franchises, licensing laws, tariffs, protective tariffs, the operation of minimum wage and pro-union legislation, government-owned or subsidized enterprises, a socialist society, and, however ironic it may be, the antitrust laws. Exclusive government franchises reserve markets to the exclusive possession of the holders of the franchises and do so by means of the government's initiation of force. Leading examples of this category of monopoly are electric, gas, and water service, cable television, local telephone service, and in many localities, local bus service. In each case, no one but the government franchise holder is legally allowed to sell the service in question in the particular market. Anyone else who might wish to sell the service in that market is stopped by law and the threat of physical force that stands behind the law. Since the provision of such service does not represent an act of force, stopping its provision by means of the use of force represents an initiation of force, an act of aggression on the government's part. In connection with monopoly in the form of exclusive government franchises, what is essential is not the fact that there is one supplier, that there is only one supplier. There might well be just one supplier in these cases under the freedom of competition. What is essential to monopoly is that physical force is initiated in order to keep out of the market sellers who might otherwise wish to be in it. That the determination of the fact that there is just one seller and which particular one seller it is made by means of the initiation of physical force, not by the freedom of competition. Under the freedom of competition, Alcoa was for many years practically the only seller of aluminum ingot in the United States. Nevertheless, it was not a monopoly according to the political concept of monopoly, for its position did not rest on the initiation of physical force, but on its ability and willingness to produce and sell its aluminum at prices that were profitable to it, but yet too low for any potential competitor to be profitable. It is possible, indeed likely, that economies of scale associated with most or all of the cases presently falling under the category of exclusive government franchise monopoly would make possible a situation similar to that of Alcoa. A single electric or gas company providing service in a given area would not constitute a monopoly if, in order to be in that position, it offered its customers lower rates than any other potential supplier offered. What would be crucial is that under the freedom of competition, precisely this is what it would have to do if it wished to be the sole supplier. Indeed, in order to become the sole supplier, it would almost certainly have to offer its customers contractual guarantees concerning its rates so that they would not have to fear temporary arbitrary increases in the period in which competitors did not yet have the time required to enter the field. In other words, to become the sole supplier of gas or electricity and so forth under the freedom of competition, a firm would have to offer a long-term contractually guaranteed price that was below what its potential competitors were prepared to offer. It should not be necessary to explain that exclusive private franchises, such as the right to own and operate a Coca-Cola bottling plant or a McDonald's hamburger restaurant, do not represent any kind of initiation of force. The name and formula of Coca-Cola and the name and supplies provided by McDonald's are the private property of these concerns, and they have the right to determine who is and who is not to receive their private property or its use. It would be an initiation of force, theft, to use their property against their will. The government, on the other hand, does not and should not own any property whose use it may give to some and withhold from others. It certainly does not and should not own the land of the country. The citizens are the owners of the land and all that is upon it. They alone have the right to determine who can and who cannot use the property of the country. In denying anyone the right to undertake economic activity,
the government simply initiates the use of force. Now, I will not offer a summary because I have run 7 minutes over. I'll simply say that in my next and final lecture on Saturday, I'll present the further leading applications and implications of the political concept of monopoly. So I'm sorry to stop more or less at a flat point, but that's in the nature of the case. So thank you very much. So now, if there are any questions, we can turn to them. Yes, the gentleman in the far rear. I can barely hear you.
We've got the transition to a gold standard, a system where bank deposits are backed by gold. We know the bank increases the value of gold from its current value of about $400 to many tens of thousands of dollars. This would seemingly increase the gold price. This would seemingly increase the wealth.
Excuse me. Let me. I think I get the general drift of the question, and it doesn't sound like it's connected with the subject of monopoly. Am I mistaken? Do you have some way to connect this significantly to the question of monopoly?
It was a more general question.
Well, then I would appreciate it if at least we could postpone that, or maybe we could talk privately, and let me give people an opportunity to raise questions specifically in connection with monopoly. Mr. Ballou.
I was wondering, you mentioned pure competition briefly, and it occurred to me that a lot of this misconception about monopoly is also based on the misconception about what competition is.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in essence, an epistemological error that some economists made to assume perfect knowledge in markets, that if pure competition not only involved the idea of a large number of very small producing not just any product, but the fact that each of them also knew everything there was to know about the
product.
So it's an epistemological
blunder. Mr. Ballou makes the observation that there are epistemological errors in connection with the concept of pure competition, which I briefly referred to. I'll say there certainly are, and they go much beyond the assumption of the need for perfect knowledge, but everything that I have to say about that subject I've said in my article, Platonic Competition, which, as I now indicate, is available as a pamphlet. So both that doctrine would really need to be analyzed alongside the economic and political concepts of monopoly, but I can't do it at the moment. Mr. Coates.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could talk more about other aspects of the utility business. Long-term contracts, I can see there have to be some variability for the price of fuel and things.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other potential ways that there could other competition could arise? I assume that people might not be solely protected by long-term contracts.
Well, there could well be other forms that I can't anticipate in advance what they might be. But I think it is a common practice that goods are bought on a long-term contractual basis and variability is allowed. Perhaps the price fluctuates in accordance with the price of the most basic material. Conceivably, I don't say this is how it would have to be, but it might be that if we had private water supplies, there'd be a wholesale water price, at least in different regions, and the contracts might read that the supplier guarantees to supply water at 20% above the wholesale water price, depending on what the circumstances were. Now, of course, in order to have such a system operate, an important presupposition would be a sound monetary system. It would be absurd if you've got a contractual price of any kind and the price is made worthless by currency debasement. So part of the context would have to be a proper monetary system, which would mean a gold standard. This gentleman over here on my left, yes, with a purplish shirt or bluish? Yeah.
You mentioned the monopoly. Right.
It seems to me that argument rests on the idea that the consumer has a right to a commodity at some given price. And I wondered if that was correct.
All right. You're saying that the argument that monopoly, the existence of a single seller automatically confers arbitrary power by allowing him to charge an arbitrarily high price, that rests on the notion that the consumer has a right to some definite price. I would say that that is not the critical notion that's present here. You see, there are contexts in which one could say there's a misconception about what the consumer thinks he has a right to, but there could be contexts in which people could be incredibly gouged, and these come up by virtue of government intervention. For example, imagine that the government has a monopoly on cigarettes, and there are people who value smoking very highly. Well, maybe the government would charge them $5 for a pack of cigarettes. Now, you could not say that the essential problem there is the consumers don't have any special right to a pack of cigarettes at a specific price. What people do have a right to, I believe, is whatever prices can be established under the freedom of competition. People have a right to those types of prices which will be established with the legal freedom of competition on the part of suppliers. And to the extent that that is violated, they do have a just grounds for complaint. Now, the unfortunate misconception is that that it is usually believed that people can be arbitrarily gouged even in face of the existence of legal freedom of competition. It is thought that if we have legal freedom of competition, well, then the private cigarette companies will somehow arbitrarily charge $5 for a pack of cigarettes. The oil companies will be charging $5 a gallon for gasoline, and so on. And these types of claims are widely believed, and it's thought that this is what the monopolies in the economic sense can achieve. Now, it's an important job to explain why this is not so. When you have freedom of competition, even in cases in which there is just one supplier, that supplier will not be able to charge prices for very long, at any rate, that are above prices that correspond to the costs of production of other potential suppliers. If there were one oil company, there could only be one oil company if that oil company were charging prices which were unprofitable for other oil companies to try to sell at. It would have to charge prices too low for others to make money at. Now, there are various questions that can be raised in connection with this. There's a doctrine known as predatory price cutting, whereby the large firm supposedly has it in its power to drive out the small firm anytime it wishes, and so establish the ability to charge arbitrarily high prices. Now, perhaps it's worth spending a moment or two on that, because this is something widely believed. The argument runs along these lines. Here's Big John. He's Rockefeller. He's big and rich, and he is in a position deliberately to slash his prices, run at a loss, which he can afford because he's big and rich, and Little Joe will have to sell at these low prices, but Little Joe, because he's poor and little, can't afford the losses, will be driven out of business, and then Big John can charge anything he likes and can threaten to repeat the lesson to any new Little Joe. And so on this basis, people believe that once a private firm becomes the sole supplier, it can do whatever it likes. Now, there are some very important things that are overlooked here. Namely, if Big John and Little Joe are operating in the same market, let's imagine we start off, the price of oil is a dollar a gallon or whatever. Here we have a price. We have a cost. And we have a quantity. All right, here's Big John and Little Joe. All right, now let's suppose that initially Big John is selling 90 units and Little Joe is selling only 10 units. The price is a dollar. That's for both of them. The cost is 90 cents. All right, how much profit does Big John make? He has sales. He has sales of 90 units times a selling price of $1. He has sales of $90. Little Joe has sales of $10. Big John has costs of 90 cents a unit times $90. He has costs of 81. Little Joe has costs of $9. Now, Big John's profit is $9. Little Joe's profit is $1. And now Big John is going to slash the price in order to make Little Joe run at a loss. Well, what does he have to do to himself? Suppose Big John wants to put the price at Little Joe's cost, 90 cents. All right, Little Joe will have to sell at 90 cents. Little Joe will sell his 10 units at 90 cents, and he'll only take in $9. So what's happened to Little Joe's profit? It's wiped out, right? But what's happened to Big John's profit? How much, on what volume must he take the price reduction? On his 9 times greater volume. So he has to lose 9 times as much. Now, this sounds more like the bigger they come, the harder they fall. And you might raise the question, well, what if Big John has lower cost than Little Joe? Suppose Big John can produce the item at 80 cents a unit while it takes Little Joe 90 cents. Well, in that case, Big John would initially have been making $18 profit while Little Joe... Big John would have been making $18 profit while Little Joe was making only $1 profit. What would have to happen to Big John's profits to eliminate Little Joe's profits? He'd still have to reduce them $9 for every $1 by which he reduced Little Joe's profit. This kind of policy is suicidal. Large firms have not practiced this policy. If they have, they've lost by it. And there was a very lengthy historical investigation precisely in connection with the Standard Oil Company, an article called Predatory Pricing, the Standard Oil New Jersey Case. I can give you an exact citation. It appeared in the Journal of Law and Economics in October 1958. It's by a man named John S. McGee. And he studied the entire record of Standard Oil's history and found they never did this because it would have been very, very unprofitable. Yes, this gentleman right here.
What are the differences between this kind of example and dumping?
What are the differences between this kind of example and dumping? Dumping is essentially this kind of argument. The supporters of the dumping doctrine claim today, for example, that the Japanese are dumping goods in the United States, goods which they're selling here at a loss to themselves for no other purpose than to harm the business of the domestic American firms and wait till they've gotten the American firms out, then we're going to really be paying $1 million for these Toyotas. Now, notice one interesting little wrinkle. The firms who are complaining are firms that only a few years ago would have been in the Big John category. That's one little bit. But as a broader principle, this notion that the Japanese are engaged in any kind of significant dumping contradicts the whole record of their success. Japan has not grown on the strength of losses. What has enabled the Japanese economy to grow is producing at a very, very high profit, and in particular, exporting at a very, very high rate of profit. And the same point applies to this nonsense that the Japanese are able to do things because MITI, or whatever it is, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, they have more clever bureaucrats than we do. That is nonsense. The Japanese government has not subsidized the success of Japan. The greater resources at the disposal of the Japanese government are the byproduct of the success of the Japanese economy. To the extent that the Japanese firms have been left free to do what's profitable, that has been the basis of their growth. Now, you might find an occasional isolated instance where someone might have sold below cost. I think in that case, they lost. It's certainly not conceivably the explanation of the growth of Japan. Nor are government subsidies any basis of their success. Private firms, keeping their own profits, invest those profits in the most profitable lines. To the extent that the Japanese government would tax the profitable firms to invest in firms that the businessmen think are not going to be profitable, which is why they don't invest in them, to whatever extent the Japanese government has practiced subsidies, their rate of progress is less than it could have been, spectacular as their record is. How much do we have time for? Okay. Mr. Hicks. Yes, to say that Alcoa was a monopoly is to implicitly accept the anarchic concept of monopoly. The concept of monopoly means the reservation of a market or part of a market on the basis of the initiation of force. Alcoa did not have its market on that basis. I think the term coercive monopoly is a mistake because it starts out by applying a concept whose basic purpose and nature is to describe some evil. The term monopoly implies some kind of evil, I think, and that's already established in the language. And then to use that term to refer to activities which really are good and to say, well, they're still monopolies, but they're not coercive monopolies. I think it's tarring them with a brush. It's much better to say that they are not monopolies. And you see, you're putting the stress, in the case of Alcoa, you're looking as something essential that they're the one firm. That you're thinking it's critical they're one, but they're not a coercive monopoly. Well, what I'll be showing on Saturday is that there are many, many important cases of monopoly where there are thousands of firms, and that you can have a monopoly in which thousands of firms are protected against the competition of just one. So all of the critical underpinnings of the concept of monopoly, I think, need to be changed, and the political concept represents a change in various aspects. This gentleman right here. Yeah.
Me? Okay.
Yeah.
The definition of freedom that you would advocate would specify that the initiation of force was by government. In other words, we can have our rights violated by private individuals, not our freedom.
No, I think the best way to define it is to say freedom is the absence of the initiation of physical force, in particular by the government or with the sanction of the government. So I think we should retain the idea that if someone comes and kidnaps you, your freedom is violated. No reason not to call that a violation of freedom. But at the same time, it is critical that the great stress be placed on the government's initiation of force. Mr. Subramanian. The question basically is, to what extent is my discussion basically different from that of von Mises? Von Mises does not have the political concept of monopoly. I think in Mises' economic writings, his treatment of the question of monopoly is actually the weakest portion of his writings. Because von Mises basically accepts the economic concept of monopoly, but at an earlier stage of development. He would not be nearly as bad on the subject as people since the 1930s, but he does regard, he does say there are private monopolies. Do we have any time for any more? Last one. Okay, this gentleman right over here.
Would you care to comment on the concept of derivation of shared monopoly, which recently came up a few years back?
Shared monopoly in the cereal industry. I would say that the concept is invalid. There are no private monopolies. Under the concept of oligopoly, it's commonly argued that the variety of large businesses act as though a monopolist would. That, for example, if we have Post and Kellogg's, each would behave as if the one represented the entire industry. I think that's what you're referring to. And I think that is totally invalid. Okay, I think we have to draw a line here. So thank you very much.